What makes a great pair of glasses? At Warby Parker, it's all the invisible extras without the extra cost. Their designer quality frames start at $95, including prescription lenses, plus scratch-resistant, smudge-resistant, and anti-reflective coatings, and UV protection, and free adjustments for life. To find your next pair of glasses, sunglasses, or contact lenses, or to find the Warby Parker store nearest you, head over to warbyparker.com. That's warbyparker.com.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
And we are a podcast out of New York City. We do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. It's also streamed on YouTube, Facebook, your regular internet places. And this is one of the first live shows we've done in years. We used to do it live every week pre-pandemic. So we're very excited to be here at Fan Expo New Orleans. We're recording this later for folks as well. And we have an amazing guest here on the panel, Mark Guggenheim. Mark, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, so
great
excited
to have you.
Very excited to chat. We used to chat back in the day,
yes.
Back at New York Comic Con.
Yes.
In the old skybox,
the
looking
old
down
days,
on everybody.
The good old days.
Ah, the good old days.
Also, did you guys like moderate like a Spider-Man kind of panel in like one of those
probably
oh, yes.
like one of those like theater spaces or theatrical spaces in New York?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think I was either there or was on the panel. I can't remember. It's so long ago.
Yeah. Yes, we definitely I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a fun cuz we had a bunch of you guys
it
who
was,
were working
yes, yeah,
on
I
it.
Think it was like it was the Spidey oh, yeah. Webheads, the Brain Trust.
Yeah, right, for the
brand new day.
Yeah. Yes, it's all coming
it's
back
all
now.
It's all coming back to me now.
Before we get too into it, and before we talk about the comic books, I do want to start off on a serious note because you are L.A.-based.
I am.
And
for now.
Yes, your family is safe.
Yeah, they are safe.
That's good. But we did want to bring up, at least for anybody either in the audience or anybody listening, there's a couple of charities that people can check out if they do want to support folks out there.
Yes.
You mentioned two of them.
Yes, the LA Firefighters Foundation and the California Foundation.
Yeah.
And there's also Jose Andres World Kitchen.
Oh, yeah. World Central
has
Kitchen.
Also been involved,
so
and they're a terrific organization as well. I mean, truth be told, like there's a lot of really great organizations that are helping out. I don't think you can go wrong with any one of them.
Yeah.
So, you know, every little bit does count. And there's a lot of GoFundMes that have been set up for various, people who have lost their homes. I know several writers who, you know, and I've been signal boosting those GoFundMes on my on my Blue Sky account. I got off of Twitter after the election.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a
not
lot
to string
of
together multiple serious topics.
I know, right?
We're going
right.
to hit everything.
Yes.
Thank you for coming to
Comic-Con. This is a hard-hitting podcast, which
yes,
I appreciate.
Exactly. But we do appreciate it, and we appreciate you being here. I'm sorry, this is a very stressful weekend.
It's so weird to be here. I feel bad. I mean, it's fine. It's like I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't. I feel bad not being there for my kids. At the same time, I would feel bad canceling.
Yeah.
As my wife likes to point out, I'm Jewish and probably not very useful in fighting fires. So she has
to
a
be
point.
Clear, there are Jewish firefighters.
That's,
I also am Jewish.
Yes.
Yes.
There's not a lot
yes.
of them. It's sort of like Jewish policemen, you
yes.
know? but, you know, but regardless, even if I wasn't Jewish, I don't think I'd still be a very effective firefighter.
Right.
You know,
yes,
so.
You are here where you are effective, which is talking about comic books.
That's the only thing
right.
I'm good at.
Yes.
Only thing I'm good at.
So what has the con been like for you so far?
It's been great. It's been great. Yeah, everyone's really friendly. This is my only my second time in New Orleans.
Mm.
My first time in New Orleans. I'm returning to the scene of the crime because my last time I was in New Orleans, it was for the filming of the critically acclaimed Academy Award winning Green Lantern movie that I co-wrote. I have an interesting relationship with New Orleans. It brings back a lot of
where did you film? Where did you, what areas did you film Green Lantern in?
I honestly don't remember.
Okay.
I was only there for a day. You have to bear in mind, like, screenwriters were not, like, really welcome on movie sets.
Yeah, hated almost by himself.
Yeah, pretty much. So it's like, I went sort of like, it was a pity, like, not me extending pity to them extending pity to me.
Yeah.
A pity, you know, sort of like, oh, yeah, come visit and then get the hell out. You know, I went. It was interesting. They were shooting a climactic scene from the, from in the hangar where Hal is fighting Hector Hammond, which, you know, it was cool.
Yeah.
I'm more familiar with television, and I'm used to shooting multiple setups a day, like sometimes like 90 setups a day. And they were like, yeah, we're getting like two shots.
Yeah.
That's our pace.
That's crazy.
Yes. Well, that's features for you.
Yeah.
I feel like the Green Lantern movie has sort of risen in esteem a little bit, though, in
really?
The last. Don't do I was not,
there was literally
you.
Only there was only one direction to go, so yeah, it's possible.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Are you feeling any of that, or how has it changed? How has it changed in the
years? Will say I think that people more people come up to me at cons and go, I really like that movie, and I think the reason it's risen in esteem is, if you compare it to a lot of movies that came after, it looks pretty. I mean, let's be honest. There's some superhero movies that makes Green Lantern look like Godfather Part II.
Let's just list them right now.
One of them is Godfather Part II.
I thank those movies. but no, I mean, like, I think, the movie has its pros and its cons. And I'm the last person to ask, simply because I'm not objective. And, I always say, I owe a script or something, and the producer or the studio or the network will be like, are you happy with the script? I'm like, I'm the last person anyone should be, asking that question of. My opinion matters the least in the entire process, number one. Number two, the way I know it's time to turn in a script is when I hate it. Like, it's like, oh, I hate it. Now it's time to turn in. Like, because I'm just so sick of it, I'm a bad judge of my own work.
Well, pivoting off of that then, to talk about something where you did have a little more control, you were the, I think this is the technical term, overseer of the Arrowverse.
I like to say I was like a co-founder, co-architect. Because there were a lot of people involved with the Arrowverse, and I don't like to take more credit than I deserve on anything, particularly the Arrowverse, which was such a group effort and such an ensemble.
Well, I was talking to these guys a little earlier today, and I watched, I think, every episode of every Arrowverse show. Watching, I know you weren't really exactly involved with this part of it, but watching the last episode of Superman and Lois, which was a good episode of television.
Yes, great episode of television.
I was struck with this feeling from my end, from a viewer end, of like, oh, this is the last time I'm going to watch this universe, but also, frankly, this is probably the last time we're going to watch the CW. Yeah. What was it like for you? What was the feeling when that aired?
Oh, when Superman and Lois aired?
Well, just sort of when this is all finishing.
When it all finished. It's funny. For me, the decline of the CW and the demise of the Arrowverse, it was kind of like this slow motion train wreck. It was like, oh, CW's getting sold. Oh, wait a second, Legends isn't getting picked up. And it's weird. I think the other thing that made it weird for me was, after Crisis on Infinite Earths, I stepped away.
Yeah.
And had I known there was only like a year of, the universe left to it, I would have stuck around. I think I could have avoided certain things, certain problems, certain mistakes that were made in terms of, again, if you know that something's ending, you can be better position to give it a proper send-off.
Yeah. And it feels like that model of television in general, but specifically superhero TV, is going away, where it's like, we're going to make a bunch and we're going to like figure it out, the old way of making TV, quote unquote.
Yeah.
What do you feel like we lose by going away from that and doing now the more like very specifically arced television that happens?
It's funny. It's a great question. A question that I've really sort of been wrestling with just as a creative, and also as a viewer, I miss those long seasons. I honestly miss the messiness of them.
Right.
It's funny, like a lot of times I would watch television kind of like a sports fan, like, oh, that show's having a really good season.
Yeah.
Like, they're just like, because it is a little bit like sports, in the sense that, like, I always say, I was actually saying to a fan at the con earlier today, like, I do think it's like baseball. It's like, you can have the exact same team year to year, But whether or not you reach the playoffs is going to really be dependent on a lot of things that are out of your control. And I like watching a show that had a bad season and came back and, you know, recovered. You know, I also, the other thing that I think is really, 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 really missing is it just takes so long between seasons now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That I've forgotten, you know, everything that's happened, you know, and, you know, some shows are better about returning than others, but, you know, this short order streaming model that we're now living in, it means you have a different relationship with television. You have a different relationship with the stories, and it, I don't want to like sound old, like be like, well, it's new, so I don't like it, but it is different, and I miss certain elements of the old days.
It feels like the CW way, or the way from the past. I don't want to call it the old way, but
it's the old ways.
It's the old ways. I believe in the old ways.
Yeah.
It feels like that's more like comics.
Yes. So oh my God, totally.
That
yes,
made it much
absolutely.
More translatable as a concept. Like pivoting in mid-season is how we make comics. It's like going forward always.
No, totally. I mean, it was you know, the crossovers were our annual JSA crossover, like on the Arrowverse shows. Like, yeah, no, it was a lot more like comics. You also, when you've got 23 hours versus 8, you can tell a lot more story.
Yeah.
And you can have like a real, like, each season could have its own identity, its own beginning, middle, and end. Like, on the Arrowverse shows, we plotted out the seasons in advance, you know, and we structured them into, like, a three-act structure. So, like, we knew we were building up to, like, the mid-season, you know, the Christmas finale, the mid-season finale, the season finale. Like, and I don't know, there's I think, a lost art, you know, an art that is being lost in moving away from that. I don't think we're ever going to see 22 episodes again, but I'd like to see, you know, 16.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, I think it allows for what you're talking about here, those kind of looser episodes in the middle where you could really explore character. And it drives me up the wall when I see people online saying, they usually use the term, oh, that was just a filler episode. All you did was explore the characters and have them talk to each other. But those are the best ones.
I think, you know, what it allowed for is different people will have different opinions on what the best ones are.
Sure.
And the nice thing about 22 episodes is you could give everyone what they were looking for. The people who want the character study, they got, you know, you could do that. You could, you know, we called them departure episodes. Mm. You know, where you sort of break from form. And, yeah, those are always sort of some of my favorite episodes. But it's like, you know, I was talking to a friend about The X-Files the other night. Mm. And, like, The X-Files is a great example of, like, you could have, you know, you had the Monster of the Week episodes, but you also had the mythology episodes. And then you had the crazy, you know, Clive Bruckman's Final Repose or Humbug episodes, which were just like so crazy. Where do the cops cross over? You know, if you're only doing 8 episodes a season, it's very hard, if not impossible, to quote unquote burn off an episode with an experiment.
You don't get the weird stuff.
Yeah, you don't get the weird stuff. And I miss the weird stuff. I miss, you know. You know, it's funny. People used to call it like stunt. You know, you do like a sweep stunt, and it's like, but I miss those. Like, I miss the live episode of ER.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, they had Quentin Tarantino direct an episode. Like,
That's right. Come on,
great stuff. Like, you know, I would love. I wish we could get back to that, but in order to do that, the seasons have to be longer, and at the end of the day, the studios and the streaming platforms, they're going to listen, as they always do, to the market. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately, the market is not voting with their feet. You know, I don't know if you guys have noticed, but there's a whole lot less television coming out now. Like, a lot less. And you're not drinking from the fire hose anymore. And
That's my favorite way to drink.
Right?
Right from the fire hose.
Now it's like you're getting, like, kind of like, you know, just drips and drabs. And unfortunately, What the reason that is happening, I mean, yes, there were like the writer's strike and the actor strike and the industry contraction leading to a lack of content for viewers. But the viewers haven't responded by canceling their subscriptions.
Yeah.
So what that's done is it's told the studios and the streamers, oh, wait a second, we don't need to order as many television shows because again, they only care about how many subscribers they win or lose. And if they're not losing any subscribers at, you know, producing 10% less content, you know, 10% of the content that they were previously producing, guess what? You're stuck with only 10% of what they previously were producing.
I feel like there was almost a change at one point. We're getting very off topic from comic book TV shows, yeah. But back like a year or two ago when Suits ended up on Netflix and exploded, where suddenly everybody's like, okay, people want these 22 episode shows. Here we go. Has that feeling got away?
Gone away. Oh, I mean, I think like, you know, The Pit, which, you know, premiered on Max. It's like 15 episodes. Like, that's a real throwback. And I'm rooting for that show because, you know, I would like to see more, you know, again, if you know, the audience votes with their money or their feet, like, you know, if a lot of people are watching it, that'll encourage people. But it's funny, like, I recently pitched a show that was, like, designed for, like, a 15 to 22 episode season, and it was everything they claimed that they wanted after Suits was, had a resurgence. And everyone passed. So it's I don't really know if you guys really know what you want, you know?
Well, and I had a show recently that we wrote the pilot, and we were seeing if they were going to pick it up. And they got on the phone. They were like, really love this, but we can't pick it up. And honestly, we never could. I was like, please don't say that.
Wow, they said the quiet part out loud.
Yeah, I was like shocked. And that to me, I'm like, well, that's got to be scary for you on your job, guys. Like, what are we doing here?
I don't think they know what they're doing, unfortunately. Yeah. There's a lot of fear that's driving the entertainment industry right now. You know, and it's... I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
Your mic is off.
That's why you can't get a question.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. Thank you. I just want to talk a little bit about your process. Also, first off, thank you for all your work. I get excited when I see your name, whether it's on the screen or on the comic book. So,
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. But and super fan of the Arrowverse, very much so. But I want to talk about, like, when you're sitting down, like, how do you put your Arrow hat on? Like, how do you kind of, like, get in these mindsets for different people that you're kind of writing for?
Oh, great question. I will say, like, you know, towards the end, but, like, you know, for a good chunk of it, it just sort of became second nature. But I would say at the beginning, whenever I'm working on any kind of project, I always like pick what I call tuning forks, which is a TV show, a movie, a script that is the same, you know, captures the same tone and the same vibe that I'm chasing for whatever the project is. And I would, you know, just, I'll like consume 5 to 10 minutes worth of that thing. And it kind of like puts the, you know, it's like it sounds the right note that I'm trying to hit, sort of like a singer, and that really sort of helps me. It's also like inspirational because I'm only picking things that are really good. So like I'm picking things that are like inspiring me to be good.
You know, Can you give us an example of a couple of your?
Yeah, like when I was working on the crossovers, I would always check out the first two Avengers movies.
Oh wow, that's awesome.
Because I thought, look, Joss Whedon, canceled, not canceled, like him, hate, love him, hate him, whatever. I don't think Joss gets enough credit for just how monumentally difficult the first Avengers movie had to have been.
Yeah.
I mean, to take all these characters who all were introduced in completely different movies with wildly different tones and approaches and make it all work together like seamlessly. He actually made it look easy. Oh my God, like what an achievement.
Yeah.
And I always said, you know, when we were doing the Arrowverse, Marvel gave us the answers to the test. So, like, you know, when we first started doing the crossovers, I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to look to see what Joss did with Avengers just to, you know, see, like, because again, he had the same, he conquered the same problem we had, which is Arrow and Flash are very different tonally. Arrow and Flash and Legends are very different tonally. Like, how do you make these characters all work together
and construct a new tone? I feel like the Joss scripts got this bit what became the Marvel tone out of a recipe of like these things don't match. This is a broken glass.
But what was great about those episodes is you really, like he's saying, like it was fun to see Oliver kind of tone it down a little bit and be around Barry. And it was like, oh, a different side of both of them.
It brought out a different side of both of them. I think like the whole thing about like Dig, you know, throwing up every time.
Yeah.
But it's like, because when we combine the two shows, my bigger concern was Arrow, not Flash, simply because Arrow was so grounded and started off in such a real-world kind of place that I felt in order for it to work, our real-world characters responding to these very unreal situations, that had to be grounded in some emotional reality. You know, I'm kind of like, you can get away with writing the craziest stuff you've ever seen, but the only way to do that is if the characters have a reaction that's realistic. You know, like I'm pitching a new series that's based on an adaptation of a novel, and the novel involves like this worldwide event. And one of, you know, the things that I told the executives was I kind of have a barrier to entry a little bit with this aspect of the novel, because everyone in the world of the novel pretty much accepts the worldwide event as true and real, and you know, and it's a major status quo world change, and the world's like, okay, yeah, we're cool, that's good. And I'm like, that strikes me as emotionally unrealistic. Personally, I'm not interested in realism, like, and logic the way a lot of, quite frankly, writers are. I'm far more concerned with emotional realism and emotional logic and feeling the reality of people's reactions to things.
Over the past 75 years, more than 10,000 chemicals have entered our food supply, but the EU allows just 300 additives. At Thrive Market, we prioritize quality, banning over 1,000 ingredients found in conventional grocery stores. Our Healthy Swap scanner helps you find better versions of your pantry essentials without the junk, dyes, or fillers, and everything is delivered right to your doorstep. So shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health at thrivemarket.com/get started for 30% off your first order and a free $60 gift.
Hearing you talk about this, and to loop it back to the crossovers for a second, it feels like knowing that going into that first crossover where it was, okay, about gelling the toads, that you gave yourself an extra added level of challenge each time out?
Every time, yeah. Each time we're like, okay, we're increasing the degree of difficulty.
Yeah.
And that was very much by design. Probably pretty stupid.
Yeah, I was going to say, what do you like skiing down the cliff?
I can't even tell you. It was more like, sort of like the way the whole universe was built was like, okay, we did this one thing. Now how do we build on that? And it was like, oh, okay, we pulled this off. Maybe we can pull that off. It's just, I don't know. I like the fact that we continue to increase the degree of difficulty.
Did doing Crisis on Infinite Earths, did that kill you?
Yes, it broke me. Yeah. It broke me. It was tough. You know, it is also, it was hard because, when I pitched, you know, every crossover, I would go in with the other showrunners, of course, and pitch to the brass at the network and the studio. And, you know, I was pitching Crisis, and I basically, you know, I was pitching to people who never read Crisis. They don't revere it.
And that's hard to explain.
And so my pitch really started off with, like, I need to tell you how important this story is.
Yeah.
Because no matter what we do, we have to be able to honor this material, because I just won't allow myself to be involved with the bad version of it. I've lost my train of thought. Where was the question?
I don't know that I had a question so much as, wow, that seems difficult.
Oh, so yes, it nearly broke me. I was going to say it nearly broke me. But an incredible ensemble of people, like all the showrunners working together. We assembled a writer's room specifically for Crisis. Everyone really sort of pulled together. And believe it or not, the whole event actually went through relatively smoothly. One thing I should say is, yes, each year we made ourselves more, our challenge, our lives more difficult. But each year we also learn something from the previous year. So we like started building in like certain production dates and certain like swing dates and padding, and we like, you know, we paid forward everything we learned. With Crisis, everything actually went incredibly smoothly with only one exception. There's a good, I mean, there's a huge luck factor involved here, because it's not like a movie. You can't do reshoots or you can't do major reshoots. You know, you're having to hit a network television schedule. Like, no one's like going to wait for the episode. You know, it's not like streaming where, you know, you can hold an entire season back for an extra 6 months or a year.
Plus, you have to be a specific time limit on the, unlike streaming as well.
So the climax in Act 5 of the Hour 5, which is the Legends episode, we had set aside two dates, the back-to-back dates, to shoot the climax outside. And it's Vancouver, and I will say the weather gods have always really shined on us and really smiled on us, except for that, for that sequence. One day it was blazingly sunny, and the other day it was unbelievably cloudy in Vancouver-y.
And which for people outside of production, that's like the worst possible thing when you're trying to marry shots.
Nothing cut together, and it was a total disaster. I mean, it was like one of the worst things that ever happened in the history of the shows, quite frankly.
Yeah.
You know, we did do reshoots, but at the end of the day, like, the reshoots are never, you don't have as many resources and everything. But that's the only thing that happened that was like, oh damn. Everything else, things worked out better than expected. Like, people are always asking, like, why'd you put in so many crossovers? And I mean, it's not crossovers, cameos. And I'm like, well, you have to understand, we didn't think we were going to get all these people. The way I described it was, we basically had to overbook the plane.
Yeah.
And kind of like what happens when you overbook a plane is everyone said yes. I mean, literally, like, almost everyone we went to said yes. And the people who said no were people who literally couldn't do it. Like Cameron Cuff from Krypton couldn't do it because he was shooting on another show and couldn't make it work. You know, the Lucifer crossover. Let me tell you how the Lucifer crossover happened. Like,
okay.
So, you know, I had been working with Joe Henderson and Ildi Moldrovich, who were the showrunners of Lucifer at the time. They really wanted Lucifer to, you know, appear in the crossover. We wanted to make it happen. They shoot in Los Angeles. We shoot in Vancouver. But we were like, they were going to make it work so the actor could be available. And Netflix killed it. Netflix said no.
Really?
And then I was on one of my many phone calls. Almost every day I'd get a phone call from someone at the studio yelling at me. like, basically, like, I'm spending too money, I'm spending too much money. Now, you have to understand, I was spending not a lot of money, but a lot of money for us, but not any money that they hadn't already given me. Like, you know, and I kept saying, like, as long as I bring this in on budget, what do you care how I spend the money? Like, just, and by the way, when have I ever not brought something in on budget?
Yeah.
So leave me alone.
Yeah.
But we were originally going to build the satellite, the monitor satellite, and it was going to be like $250,000 set.
Wow.
And, you know, basically, you know, sort of doing the math, I realized we can't afford this. Or that $250,000 is better spent in other directions. And, you know, anyway, I got this phone call, person yelling at me on the other line, and he's like, I'm so glad the Lucifer cameo couldn't happen. I'm so glad, because every time you do one of these, you bring in a character from these other places, it diminishes the crossover. I'm like, well, actually, no, we have completely different opposite philosophies. But I got off the phone, I was so annoyed. And I had just saved $250,000 that I picked up the phone and I called someone at Netflix who I had worked with in the past. I'm like, I need a favor.
You got a Spike cameo to happen.
I did the cameo out of Spike. And actually what happened was we were about $10,000 apart budgetarily. Not budgetarily, $10,000 apart negotiation for the, you know, for this cameo. And I'm like, give back $10,000 of my producing fee. Best $10,000 I ever spent. I have no regrets. But although my agent called me up and was like, not my agent, my lawyer called me up and was like, kind of a very strange phone call from business affairs at Warner Brothers. They said you gave them $10,000. I'm like, yes, I did. Leave it alone.
Yeah. Never ask about this money again.
Yeah.
This is jumping back a little bit, but I did want to mention something that I think is kind of underrated in terms of probably what makes shows like Arrow, but also the whole Arrowverse and all of these things work, is having the right people involved. Like, you gave a shout out to everybody at the beginning. You're like, please don't put it on me. But casting those shows, I've interviewed so many people. Everybody is so nice. Everybody's so into it. That helps, that lifts so much of the pressure and the work.
Oh, my God. Look, no one does anything of this scope alone. And we were so blessed to have such a great group of people, like, and just nice people, like, you know, like people who you want to go into work with. There was one exception, which I think we all know about, like, and, you know, but with the exception of him, it was like a family. And, and there was something special about the crossovers. Like, that was so hard on everybody, the cast especially, but like the crews on all the shows, you know, and you would be so moved if you saw just how all these people were like, they suited up for the crossovers every year. They were like, they always cared about the shows, but they went the extra mile on those events, the way we all were trying to do. And it was really, really special. Like, it was just special that we had a good group of people. And it becomes a self-perpetuating, a virtuous cycle, because when I was, like, trying to get people to, you know, actors to come on the show, I could say, but you get to work with Stephen Amell and Katie Lotz and Brandon Routh and Katie Cassidy. And, like, these are what, like, you're going to come into a warm and welcoming environment. This is going to be a set you want to come to work at each day. And, you know, I'd be a liar if all the people weren't as nice and friendly and welcoming as I was making them out to be. But so it's like, good actors and good people allow you to get more good actors and good people.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, and I know this is a big question, but are there, what are the moments you think of? Or, like, what is a moment you think of, like, oh, man, that's going to stick with me forever?
Ooh, that's a good question. Probably, depending upon which day you ask me, I'll probably give a different answer. But, like, I remember when it was the middle of season one of Arrow, and season one of Arrow was so hard. I mean, honestly, it was, like, probably the hardest year of my career. Wow. And that's even more hard than the crisis year. It was brutally difficult, because we were really trying to, we had to invent a new way to do superhero television.
Yeah, the form hadn't been set. I feel like we forget that was one of the first.
Aggrandizing way, but, like, there had been superhero shows, but we were doing it in a different way, on a different level. You know, we had these flashbacks, which I always said was like, you know, it was like doing 1.5 shows a week as opposed to one show a week. And we all went to Anaheim for WonderCon that year. And it was really the first time it hit me that people liked the show. I mean, Twitter was a thing, and, you know, people were saying nice things on Twitter, but to see all those fans and just how enthusiastic they were about the show, like, that moment really stays with me. A lot of the behind the scenes stuff stays with me, like, you know, just, you know, and sometimes it's not like singular moments. It's like when we figured out Legends, and, you know, like, and by the way, one of the things we not only figured out, but was like, first season of Legends, like, we did not it wasn't a happy set. Like, it really was not a happy set. Like, the actors were sitting apart from the rest of the crew during lighting breaks. There were a bunch of actors who were just total malcontents and just not happy to be there. And when we not only fixed the tone of the show, I think, to the good, we also fixed the working environment in the show. Because for me, the working environment is every bit as important as the creative. And by the way, I say that, that's selfish. Like, I was doing, back when we were shooting the Arrow pilot, I was also shooting another pilot in New York. It was a legal drama, and it was a total nightmare. It was just a nightmare. It was they made me cast someone I didn't want to cast. It was just terrible, terrible. Anyway, you slice it. And I was, but I was walking to the set one day, shooting in Manhattan. It's very nice. You can just walk to anywhere. And I'm walking, and it was sort of right in the middle of the shoot. And I realized, oh my God, I'm actually looking forward to going to the set. And I realized it's because it was a really, really happy set. And everyone was really rowing in the same direction. And it was just good vibes. And I realized, oh, for you know, it's not just the right thing to do, but for me, selfishly, it's what I need in order to go through what could be a very bad creative experience. As long as it's a good work environment, I can put up with, you know, all the bad notes and, you know, the actor I didn't want to cast and everything else.
I wanted to ask you about the Legends thing a little bit more, and I don't know how much you feel comfortable talking about it, but from the viewing perspective, like you said, I watched the show. I watched the first season. I was like, well, this is all right. I like some of these characters. And it's such a palpable change, I think, in the second season, but definitely like by the time they get rolling halfway through the second season. How do you start that conversation to change it in such a dramatic way?
Well, here's, okay, so here's the thing. And again, this goes back to a little bit what we were talking about, like the streaming model versus the original network model, because typically on network, what you would do is you do a pilot. And when you do a pilot, you learn so much. You learn what works, what doesn't work. You learn all these things. For example, with Legends, I remember like watching the director's cut in the editing room with Greg Berlanti and turning to Greg and going like, we made a mistake. We've been talking about this show like it's the Avengers. It's really Guardians of the Galaxy. And normally, we would be able to make that adjustment in episode two and beyond. But Legends, for good and bad, was picked up straight to series.
Right.
So the die kind of tonally and the approach and everything had been cast. And there was no opportunity really to make the kind of pivot, which is a big pivot in the case of Legends, until the end of the season.
Now, when you say there was no, you couldn't do that because the machine was in motion. You didn't have the stop of a pilot and the start of the series. So
that's
it was like
right.
You're
going straight into the next episode. And normally you have this pause and you can stop and, like I said, tailor the show to what you're seeing and what's working and what's not working. So we know those conversations that we would normally have after a pilot, we didn't get to have until after the entire first season.
Long pilot.
Yes, long pilot.
I do want to pivot just because we're running a little low on time and talk about your comic book work.
Which was ostensibly what we were supposed to do.
The postmortem on the Arrowverse panel has just ended. And now we can look into the comic book.
Okay, I'll put it on a different
hat.
You
recently did a book that we love called Torrent.
Hey, thank you.
That was great. Very intense, very upsetting at the beginning. The concept, for anybody who hasn't read it, if I can spoil it a little bit.
Oh, please, go for it.
So you have a superhero. She's a good superhero. Her sidekick gets in a very bad way because of her arch enemy. And things only get worse from there. I'm kind of badging around very specific spoilers. But without specifically being like this, it almost feels like The Raid with a superhero is sort of how I thought about it.
Yeah.
What was the impetus for this series?
It started off with just sort of a question. Like the question in my mind was, can I turn Spider-Man into the Punisher?
That's Pete's dream.
You know, so I always say, like, a lot of my later comic book work has gotten away from like intellectual exercises by design, but this was very much sort of like originally started off as like a thought experiment, and it was also like, because I knew I was working with Justin Greenwood, the artist, on it, like it was sort of designed for Justin. So I'm like trying to write a concept or come up with a concept that I know will play to all of his strengths, and he's many, but all of his strengths as a artist. But it really was like, oh, can I turn Spider-Man into the Punisher? And I leave it to people who read the book to know how successful that was.
Yeah, I think it was very successful. And you did another book, forgive me if I get the title wrong, Last Flight Out.
Last Flight Out,
which is also great. I feel like the thing that connects both of those is sort of what you were saying earlier about the show, is that like they're very big, very specific ideas, but you're grounding them in emotional realities. Is that what you're looking to do in your comic book work right now?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really... It's funny. When I started out writing comics, a lot of the stuff was like me asking questions as a fan and coming up with answers. And I got to say, that's not a good basis for a comic book. and I look back on a lot of my early comic book work going, oh, I really... you know, and yeah, so now it's... I really do try to sort of tie it in some sort of emotion, some sort of... You know, like, you know, question. You know, it could be a theme. It could be, you know, putting a character through a certain crucible. It could be, you know, some of the work I do is work for hire, where you know I'm just giving these characters and told go play, and I have to like sort of think about like, okay, what you know, what's the story I want to do that brings out, like, I'll give an example. Like, the next comic book I've got coming out is a Star Wars Jedi Knights. Mm-hmm. And it's a book takes place before Phantom Menace. It's about the Jedi. And obviously, there's a bunch of different ways, a bunch of different directions you can go with that.
Yeah.
And for me, I was like, I've seen the Clone Wars. I've seen the prequels. I've never seen the Jedi, though, be the Jedi. Like,
right.
You know, in Clone Wars, yeah, there's some of that, but for the most part, they're fighting a war, you know? I've never seen the Jedi be the guardians of peace and justice in the galaxy. And that was, like, I want to see those stories. I want to write those stories and really sort of, you know, obviously deal with each Jedi individually as a character, but also deal with the whole institution as a character itself as well.
Yeah. Now, you real quick, you were talking about the earlier on being part of the Spidey Brain Trust yeah. back in the day. Can this style of working you're talking about now, the more emotionally led and what you've been doing in your creator-owned and work-for-hire stuff, can that work in a larger model like that? And do you miss doing that?
I do. I mean, like, I really miss the webhead days. I will say, like, I've gotten also a lot better and managing my time. Like, my time management skills have, like, improved immensely since I did Spider-Man. And I look back on the Spider-Man experience, and I, you know, first of all, just as a fan, I should have stopped and smelled the roses a bit more and be like, mm-hmm. I'm writing Spider-Man. but also, I was running a show called Flash Forward at the time, and it was a very heavy lift production-wise and creatively and everything. And I don't feel like I always did a good job of balancing the two. So that's the other thing. It's like, you know, hopefully as you get older and more experienced, you learn mistakes and you learn from them and you get better. Like, you know, I just look back on that experience going like, oh, I wish my time management skills were up to the task.
Well, let's talk about what's coming forward a little bit. So as you mentioned, you're working on the Jedi Knights title. I think you also have a book that came out.
I have a novel that was published over the summer. Yeah, an actual novel, like with words, called In Any Lifetime. And it's about a quantum physicist who his wife dies in a tragic accident, and he's looking for the one parallel universe where she's still alive.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's the universe itself that's trying to stop him because the universe favors certain outcomes, otherwise known as fate. And during it, we're flashing back to their romance and their courtship and their eventual marriage. The way I sort of describe it is, what if Christopher Nolan wrote and directed The Notebook? is sort of that was what, for better or for worse, that was the vibe I was chasing. And what's really great is it's gotten an incredible response. It's got over like 6,000 reviews on Amazon, 4 out of 5 stars.
Good.
Like, what? I mean, like, if you sell if you sell 6,000 copies, you're doing pretty well these days. To have 6,000 people actually take the time to write a review, it's. It's certainly unprecedented in my experience.
Now, that sounds like a comic book concept that we're familiar with, but adapted into a different form of maybe a different genre or vibe to it. Is that a great model for novel writing, it feels like?
You know, it's funny. So I'd been working on this idea for like probably a total of 10 years, start to finish. Oh. And because my 10,000 hours are in screenwriting and in comic books, that's originally where I explored, you know, I thought about doing it as a graphic novel. I played around with it a little bit on the page, and I played around with it a bit, you know, as a screenplay. And it, you know, so because that's where my skill set lies. So it probably could work as a comic book. It could work as a... I mean, sometimes you have ideas that can only work as one thing.
Right.
This idea, I think, could work as multiple things.
Do you feel any pressure to now write the screenplay for?
I don't. I mean, honestly, like, what I've sort of done is just said, like, it's out there in the universe. If someone wants to make it into a movie, that's great. And if they want to hire me, fine. If they don't want to hire me, that's also fine. Actually, I'd almost prefer it.
Like, that would be, that's a wild thing to come, what you're saying is your main skill set. Do something outside of that and then have someone else bring it back to your realm.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. Like Last Flight Out, I'm adapting as a limited series for Netflix right now. I also did a graphic novel called Too Dead to Die that I adapted as a screenplay for Universal. And what's weird to me is first of all, whenever I write in comics or in prose, I'm not doing it with an eye towards turning it into anything. I'm doing it with an eye towards, no, the thing I want to turn it into is either a book or a comic book. But, you know, we live in a world where IP is, you know, is king. So occasionally people will be like, oh, we'd like to option this. It's weird because they come to me at a point where I've already scratched my artistic itch.
Right.
I've already said what I want to say with the story. So for like both Last Flight Out and Too Dead to Die, I actually had to like come up with not new ways in necessarily, but new ways to get excited as a writer.
Right.
You know, because the excitement of telling the story is over.
Yeah.
You know, I found like a different approach with Last Flight Out, and also, and Too Dead to Die is actually very, very different. I really like the other thing about adapting your own stuff is I really was sort of forced to walk my own talk because for years I've been adapting other people's material, and I'm always like, look, you know, different mediums have different strengths and weaknesses that require different things. You've got to, like, you know, you can't be precious. You know, you've got to, like, you have to adhere to the spirit of the thing, but other than that, it should be all bets are off. And now it's like, okay, Guggenheim, how much did you really believe that when you're the patient on the table and it's your work that's being adapted? And I will say, like, I did walk my own talk. Like I said, Too Dead to Die, because I wrote a version of Too Dead to Die that was very similar to the graphic novel, and the producers and I were like, yeah, this is never going to get made simply because it's too expensive. So I came up with almost like an entirely different story, keeping the core conceit, keeping the spirit of it, but it's a different story. And honestly, it's like one of my favorite scripts I've ever written.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That is obviously a lot of stuff, but is there anything else you want to plug?
Oh, gosh, what else? Oh, you know what? I always like to plug my newsletter. Like almost every Friday, almost, I do a newsletter called Legal Dispatch. It's on Substack. I talk about what's on my mind at the moment. Like this week I wrote about the LA fires. I'll occasionally talk about behind the scenes process stuff for me. I love to answer questions. And I have like a section called From the Vault where I'll pick something like some artifact from, you know, the Arrowverse, and be like, oh, this is here. Like 2 weeks ago I was like, this is the original designs of the Wave Rider, you know, stuff like that.
So, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Mark, thank you so much for coming out. Thanks for chatting. I do hope you and your family and everybody you know are safe. Yes. And for all of you, thank you so much for coming out. Enjoy the rest of Fan Expo. And if you're ever in New York or online, we don't do it live
anymore. If you're ever online, I don't know what you're
Do you
up
check
to.
Out the internet?
You should check
do
it out.
You guys go to the internet? Go to internet.com. Yeah. It's great.
Start with an H, the TTPS.
ComicBookClubLive.com. We stream live every Tuesday. Otherwise, enjoy the rest of the con. Good night.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Good night.
Every idea starts with a problem. Warby Parker's was simple. Glasses are too expensive. So they set out to change that. By designing glasses in-house and selling directly to customers, they're able to offer prescription eyewear that's expertly crafted and unexpectedly affordable. Warby Parker glasses are made from premium materials like impact-resistant polycarbonate and custom acetate. And they start at just $95, including prescription lenses. Get glasses made from the good stuff. Stop by a Warby Parker store near you.